as he slides the key into the car's ignition. His breathing starts to level out. In the moonlight, red streaks pattern his hands. He wipes them on his jeans and puts the car in gear. Someone will find her soon. There's so many people who love her. They'll come looking. But he'll be long gone by then. This is True Crime South Africa. I'm Nicole Engelbrecht, and you're listening to episode 170, The Murder of Alison Plaikies. And it's that time again, when I highlight the latest must-watch on CBS Justice, the home of true crime on TV. And next week, you won't want to miss an explosive look at the most notorious double murder investigation of all time, O.J. Simpson, Blood, Lies, and Murder. This two-part special reveals shocking new evidence that never made it to trial, and that's according to the lead detective in the case, Tom Lang, proves O.J. is guilty. Catch it exclusively on CBS Justice, DSTV Channel 170, on Thursday the 5th and Friday the 6th of December at 8 p.m. And a huge thank you to CBS Justice for sponsoring this episode of True Crime South Africa. Since 2019, True Crime South Africa has been telling the stories of the victims of violent crime in South Africa. The podcast is independent. That means no big or even little corporates fund it. And that's just the way I like it. And it's the only independent podcast in South Africa that consistently charts in the top 10. Keeping a podcast like this going is time-consuming. And for the most part, it remains a one-woman process. It's me. I'm the one woman. You? Yes, you. Are the reason this podcast continues to flourish and help bring in tips on missing person and cold cases. If you'd like to help keep the show running, please consider supporting our sponsors, signing up to Patreon or PayPal, follow the show on the socials, as the kids say, and share it with your fellow partners in crime. You can find our social links and learn more about our sponsors at True Crime South Africa. /donate. Shout outs to this week's Patreon and PayPal superstars. A huge thank you goes out to Lauren Patrick, Claudette Busso, Maria Balmont, Karen Zador, and Emmy Halgrain for your support on Patreon. Thank you so much, everyone. Your support really does make a huge difference. Patreon supporters get one additional exclusive episode a month, a shout-out on the pod, and other exclusive contents, including Q&As with me, as and when it's available. It's a minimum of $1 a month. I think you should do it. Please. And thank you. Kia ba. This week's episode is a case of intimate partner violence and murder. Although each and every case is important because every victim deserves a voice, when I cover various cases of intimate partner violence in a short space of time, I will admit that I sometimes wonder, should I be covering a different case instead? Is there value beyond victim centering to talking about cases with such similar circumstances over and again? The cycle of abuse is almost replicated in so many ways. But as I was researching today's case, and having that same thought again, another thought joined it. Maybe that's the whole point. Even though the tactics of the abusers and eventually killers are always so similar, the victims are always different. Some are young women, just starting out in life. Others are much older, having been married to their killers for many years. Some are poverty-stricken. Others are wealthy. They belong to all races, socioeconomic groups, and live in all parts of South Africa. And maybe that's the point. I also think the victim's family in today's case made an incredibly important discovery about something they might have been able to do to change the outcome. Not in any way to excuse the perpetrator, but as a self-reflection and a suggestion to other families, which I found really valuable. In researching today's case, I used various media articles, an episode of Heiskanoot Vare Levensdramas, and several other online sources. So, let's get into episode 170, The Murder of Alison Plaikies.
The following episode may contain sensitive material, including descriptions of violence, sexual assault, or graphic descriptions of injuries to victims. If you feel you may be triggered by such material, please consider this before accessing our content. To access trauma counseling or services, please see the helpline information on our show notes.
Alison Plaikies was born on the 8th of September 1993. She and her older brother were raised in Swellendam, where she quickly became a well-loved member of the community, affectionately called Sissy. Alison's mom, who is alternately referred to in various sources as Elise and Yvonne, says her daughter was a very good baby. But her mischievous side soon crept in as soon as she became a toddler. Her shenanigans were always good-natured, though. Like the time she refused dinner for a week, and when her exasperated mother threatened to take her to the doctor, young Alison confessed that she'd been eating at the soup kitchen down the road for a week after having tasted a bowl and decided she liked it better than her mom's cooking. In watching her older cousin, Liesel, who says she was more like a second mother to Alison, and all her friends speak about her in the Heiskanoot Vare Levensdrama episode, a smile comes to my face, despite the tragic context. Each of the people speak with such love and tenderness about the beautiful young woman whose face occasionally flashes onto the screen, that after just a few minutes, I feel sure that I would have adored her too. Alison loved music and singing, and everyone says that if Alison was awake and in a good mood, which was 95% of the time, she was also singing. For many, it would be this backdrop of humming and singing that constantly permeated any space Alison was in, that they would miss the most when, later, the silence became deafening. Alison had always loved children, her family said, and she'd been really good with them too. So when she decided, after matriculating in 2012, that she wanted to become a teacher, it seemed an excellent fit. In her first few months at the Mowbray campus of the Cape Peninsula University of Technology, Alison had continued a relationship she'd been in with a young man who her family liked very much. Everyone had said that the pair were perfect for each other. But tragically, the relationship had ended with Alison's boyfriend being stabbed to death in a mugging. Alison had been in deep grief in her first year at university and using all of her energy just to make sure she got through her coursework. She was away from her family too, and although she made friends easily, she was in a vulnerable place. And it was in that same year that a classmate of Alison's started to pay her more attention and ask her out. Philip April came from a well-respected family in Clan William. His father was a principal at one of the schools in the area, and his mother was also a professional. Philip's parents had divorced when he was a young teen, and he would later say that he'd struggled during that time and hadn't really ever gotten a hold on his mental health again after that. Rather than seeking out professional help for what was clearly a cycle of depression, Philip did what many people do. He started self-medicating with alcohol. Rather than just numbing his pain, though, Alcohol seemed to reveal an aggression in Philip that he usually hid rather well. Once that aggressive side had been unveiled, so to speak, it didn't just come out when he was drunk, and often slipped out whenever he lost control of a situation or anything in his own life. When Alison began to date the handsome, intelligent Philip April, she had no idea about any of this. It seems that most people who didn't really know Philip didn't have much of an idea of what he was actually like. Unlike Alison, who, from what everyone says, was very extroverted and made friends easily, Philip was more reserved around certain people, at least. To Alison's family, he presented as a polite and well-mannered young man. He always brought gifts whenever he and Alison visited over the university holidays. He didn't speak much, and most of her family members said it was quite difficult to get anything more than short answers out of him. But Alison seemed to be happy, and they certainly made a lovely couple. The attractive and happy couple image was promoted on Alison's social media accounts as well. She posted quite regularly on her Facebook account and had a special folder just for photographs of her and Philip, called Lip and Ally. Behind the scenes, though, Alison had started to experience Philip's darker side. Clear distinction happens over the next few years, where Alison shares bits and pieces of the truth with close friends, more people her own age. While the older people in her life, her mom and older cousin, didn't really have any idea what was going on. It's likely, at first, Alison herself didn't really know what was happening to her. Her male friends were slowly removed from her social media, and she spent less and less time with her friends in real life. Then, people started to notice bruises. There were various incidents over the course of Alison and Philip's relationship that her friends were aware of or had witnessed themselves. One was when Philip had thrown a full glass of beer at Alison's face. Another was when they were at a party together and she wanted to go home. She got in a female friend's car, and Philip opened the door and dragged Alison out by her arm onto the road. Philip was also emotionally abusive to Alison around other people too. Never her family, but usually around his friends. On one occasion, he told a gathered group of friends in front of Alison that she was pathetic and incapable of doing anything for herself, claiming that he had to do everything for her. The relationship was very much on and off, and Alison had broken up with Philip on several occasions over the years. As they both neared the end of their studies to qualify as teachers, in 2018, they were in a relationship, and both had done their student year at Cedarburg Primary in Clanwilliam, Philip's hometown. So when it came time to start applying to full-time teaching positions, Alison agreed that she would go to Clanwilliam too. At this point, another issue occurred in Philip's life, which seemed to impact him negatively from a mental health perspective. Alison graduated that year, and he didn't. Philip failed one of his subjects, which he would need to rewrite in the new year in order to qualify, and he, perhaps understandably, took that very hard. In this context, though, the way in which he related to himself and to Alison clearly made this a sticking point between the couple. There's a photograph of Alison at her graduation. She's beaming and all dressed up in her graduation gown. And there's a few photos with others who attended, members of her family. All are grinning along with her and clearly proud of her achievements and happy for her. And then there's a photograph with Philip. And it tells a story. at least in retrospect. There's not even a glimmer of a smile on his face. In fact, he looks like he doesn't even want to be there. Now, I can understand to a certain extent, for him personally, this is not a happy day. He should be graduating along with his class and his girlfriend, but he's not. He's probably feeling down on himself, unsure what the future holds, seeing everyone else moving forward when he's still stuck in place. So, I might expect to see a smile that maybe doesn't reach the eyes. But in a loving relationship, as an emotionally mature human being, you should be able to feel happiness for your partner, even if your own situation is not what you want it to be. Alison started teaching Afrikaans full-time at Cedarburg Primary in Clanwilliam in January 2019. She was immediately welcomed into the family of staff at the school and made friends easily. And although she was relatively private about her relationship, some of the teachers there would learn a few things about what was happening between her and Philip over the months that followed. The teachers at the school knew Philip, after all. He'd spent a year working there as a student teacher, in addition to being part of a well-known Clanwilliam family. When Alison moved to Clanwilliam, she needed accommodation, and she was convinced that it would be a good idea to rent a room in Philip's mother's house. Now, I'm really joining dots here for myself, but Philip was still spending a lot of time in Mowbray, trying to complete his final module so that he could graduate. And Alison was 230 kilometres away, in Clanwilliam. Over the years, he displayed a lot of controlling behaviour, both in person and when they were apart. He expected her to have her phone with her 24/7 when she wasn't with him, and if she didn't respond to his text messages immediately, he would demand to know what she was doing. So, although it may well have been convenient for Alison to move into accommodation that was available and likely affordable with someone she knew, I also can't help but think that it would have been very convenient for Philip too, to have a way to monitor her movements without even being there. Toward the middle and second half of 2019, Alison and Philip's relationship was on very rocky ground. Alison, perhaps emboldened by her newly found independence and freedom of permanent employment and just adult life, had begun to shift in her feelings around Philip. A fellow teacher and friend had also started to notice the bruises on her arms and put two and two together. One day, while having lunch in Alison's classroom, she stood up and announced to two fellow teachers present that Philip had told her that if she left him, he would kill her. He told her that if he couldn't have her, no one would. Her friend had asked her why she just didn't take out a protection order against Philip, and Alison said that she didn't want to get him in trouble with the police, and she knew that he would just violate it and be arrested. She didn't want to destroy his life, she said. She just wanted him to leave her alone. Shortly after this discussion, Alison announced that she'd broken up with Philip for good, and she was moving out of his mother's house. She rented a garden flat in Clanwilliam, and she'd bought her own car, a Hyundai i20. As had been the case during previous breakups, Philip had not left Alison alone, and regularly texted her and arrived at her flat. During this time, Alison seemed to be attempting to carry out a careful balancing act. There's no doubt that she feared what Philip was capable of. She also didn't want to be with him, so she tried to be polite and kind, but also set boundaries and regularly reminded Philip that they were not in a relationship. Occasionally, Philip would borrow Alison's car. She didn't particularly want this to happen, but she also wanted him to get on with his life. And if that helped him to do that, she would allow it every now and then. As she had when she'd been at university, Alison would go home to Swellendam during the holidays. In June 2019, she'd gone home and spent some time with her family. But when September rolled around, she told her family that she wanted to save up rather than travelling and would see them in December for a longer break instead. Sadly, this would never happen. And those June holidays were the last time her mother and close family members would ever see her alive. On Friday, the 25th of October 2019, Philip texted Alison to let her know that he'd failed his exam again on the rewrite, and he was feeling very down. He asked her if he could come visit her. Alison told him that she was sorry to hear that, but she had a lot going on and she didn't really have time for visits. She was clearly trying to avoid him using this as an excuse to re-ingratiate himself into her life. A WhatsApp exchange between the two that Friday would later be presented in court as proof that, firstly, their relationship had ended, and, to me, it also shows that Philip was still demanding of Alison's time and attention. When Philip demands to know what she's so busy with, Alison writes, "I don't mean to be rude, but I no longer have to explain anything to you." He responds with, "Yes, I know, but you lie a lot." Alison comes back with, "I'm not rude, but I'm reminding you because you act like we're still in a relationship." Again, here we see a lot of what is called fawn behaviour from Alison. She's placating him. She doesn't mean to be rude, she says. She's not being antagonistic, even though she has every right to tell him to just leave her alone. But she's learned. Blocking him is pointless. Being aggressive just makes things worse. Fawn is one of the most common responses that women display in situations of danger. It sits alongside fight, flight, and freeze, and is often built into many women and some men by society. Sometimes when children grow up in an abusive home, they learn the fawn response along with people-pleasing early on. But that wasn't necessarily true for Alison. By all accounts, her home life was peaceful and non-violent. We'll talk later about how one of her family members thinks that even this could have contributed to her finding herself trapped in this relationship. On Saturday the 26th, Alison had a full day planned with school-related stuff. During the day, she was going to a workshop being held at Cedarburg Primary, and then in the evening she'd agreed to judge a modelling competition in the area with another teacher friend. 61-year-old Anna Moton had been a cleaner at Cedarburg Primary since 2013. She'd gotten to know Alison as one of the teachers since the young woman had started working there in January. On that Saturday, the workshop was due to start at 9 a.m. But Anna arrived at 7 a.m. to start setting up the refreshments and didn't expect to see anyone else there for 2 hours at least. But just 15 minutes later, Alison arrived with a big smile on her face and a chirpy good morning for Anna. The woman asked why she was there so early, and Alison said she'd come to help her set up. She'd figured it would be quite a big job for just one person, and she wasn't doing anything at home, so she came to help. Later, when Anna would talk about this moment, even though she wasn't particularly close to Alison, her eyes misted up, and she smiled fondly at the act of kindness and humility from the young woman. Not long after Alison had arrived, she and Anna were walking up and down the stairs to the venue they were setting up, when Anna saw a man arrive. Alison clearly recognized him immediately, but it took a minute for Anna to realize that this was Philip April. Anna knew nothing about what Alison had been experiencing with Philip. She wasn't privy to the conversations Alison had had with her teacher friends, but she said that she could immediately tell from Alison's change in demeanor that she was not happy to see him. Anna says that Alison went pale in the face as Philip held out a lunchbox. He said that his mother had made food, so he'd brought some for her for lunch. Alison hadn't reached out to grab the lunchbox he'd held out, and instead just said to him that the school was providing lunch, so she was sorted. Anna said that Philip insisted, though, and eventually Alison just grabbed the lunchbox and thanked him. Then Philip asked Alison for the keys to her flat. He said that his mother was doing washing, and she'd said that he should fetch Alison's washing, and she'd do that too. Anna explained that Alison had tried to tell Philip repeatedly that she didn't need him to do her washing, but he kept pressing. And eventually she just gave him her car keys and told him that her flat keys were in the car and he should give the car keys back to Anna when he was finished. She'd get the flat keys from him when she finished with the workshop. Anna said that after Philip left, Alison seemed different, preoccupied, and not as happy as she'd been before. When the workshop ended at 2 p.m., Alison texted Philip to find out where he was so she could collect her flat keys. He said he was at a friend's house watching the rugby and braaiing, and she could come there. From this point, for several hours, we only really have Philip's account to tell us what may or may not have happened. The evidence, of course, would also later tell a story. Alison pulled up to Philip's friend's house. They were sitting on the porch after having eaten and watched the rugby, and they were drinking beer. Philip's friend said that he'd gone down to her car and walked up to her door. Only Philip knows what was discussed, but his friend said that it looked like they were arguing, and then he got into Alison's car and she drove away. Philip April claims that Alison had been arguing with him because he was drunk, and she told him that she'd brought food for him from the school event and he should come to her place and eat it. I personally find this story highly unlikely, and I think it's more likely that Philip had made an excuse about why he needed to go home with her and Alison had just caved. The friend didn't say anything about Philip having keys with him when he went down to her car, so I guess it's even possible that he'd claimed that her keys were somewhere else and he needed to go with to fetch them. Either way, Alison Plykeys was last seen alive, driving away in her Hyundai i20 with Philip April in passenger seat. About an hour and a half later, Philip arrived back at his friend's house in Alison's car. He was driving and she was not with him. They immediately noticed that he had scratches on his face and his hand was bleeding. He was also wearing different clothes to when he'd left. When asked what had happened, Philip said that he and Alison had had a fight and he'd come there to cool down before going back to sort things out. Around the time that Philip was arriving back at his friend's house, the teacher that Alison was supposed to join at the modelling competition as a judge that night phoned her. When Alison didn't answer, she texted asking whether they would be driving together or meeting there. After half an hour of the text not being read, the woman grew concerned. She knew well enough that Alison's experiences with Philip had caused her to be very vigilant with her phone, and she always answered text very quickly. After phoning for a second time with no answer, the woman decided to phone Philip. She knew that although he and Alison were broken up, he was a constant fixture around her, always aware of her comings and goings, even when Alison didn't tell him herself. He always somehow found out. Philip answered, and when the woman asked if he knew where Alison was and why she wasn't answering her phone, he told her that she was driving and they were both on their way to Lambert's Bay. The woman was very confused, and she told Philip that couldn't be right because Alison had promised to judge the competition that night, and they'd even been talking about it earlier in the day. Philip made some non-committal comments and said he'd get Alison to call her later, and then hung up. Although she knew that something was not right about the situation, Alison's friend couldn't disappoint all the youngsters who were already arriving for the modelling competition, so she went on with her night as planned, occasionally checking her phone to see if Alison had read her message. But the WhatsApp remained on one single tick, unread. Within a few hours after having sent a few messages to other friends and figuring out that no one could get hold of Alison, one of her friends reached out to Philip April's mother, Rolene. Rolene told the young woman that Alison was not with her and she hadn't seen her, but she said that Philip had been by the house just before 3:30 p.m. to shower and change his clothes, and he'd been driving Alison's car. He'd told his mother that he and Alison had had an argument, and she'd said he could take her car for the weekend. Rolene told Alison's friend that she would go and look for the young woman and let her know when she found her. Jeshvita Steenkamp was another friend and colleague of Alison's. She would later testify that Rolene April had arrived at her house that Saturday evening asking if she'd seen Alison. Jeshvita said she hadn't, and Rolene explained that no one could get hold of her, and Philip and Alison had fought. And then she dropped an unexpected bombshell. "I'm afraid the girl is lying dead somewhere." Jeshvita was horrified that Rolene would make such a leap and told her as much. Rolene then asked Jeshvita if she'd accompany her to Alison's flat. The woman lived just a few houses away, so Jeshvita agreed and the two set off. When they arrived, the gate was unlocked and they entered the property. They called out to Alison through an open window several times, but there was no response. Finally, they went to the owner of the property who lived in the main house, explained the situation, and asked if she could let them in. She grabbed the spare keys and unlocked the front door. Inside the flat, everything appeared normal and undisturbed, but the door to the bedroom was pulled closed. They called out again, wondering if perhaps Alison was asleep and just hadn't heard them, but there was no reply. Rolene asked Jeshvita to open the bedroom door. The two women stepped inside and saw the duvet cover laying on the floor. Jeshvita didn't think that was weird, at least at first, because she knew that Alison had a habit of sleeping on the floor when it was very hot. When she turned to walk out, though, Rolene had pointed to something sticking out from under the duvet cover and asked Jeshvita what it was. As her eyes focused, she realized that it was Alison's shoe and parts of her jean-clad leg sticking out from under the duvet. From the testimony I read, it doesn't appear that either woman actually looked under the duvet, but both realized that Alison must be dead, and they'd run out of the flat, and the owner had said she was calling police. When police arrived on the scene, they found Alison Plykes deceased on the floor of her bedroom. Lifting the duvet revealed an enormous pool of blood and Alison's body, which had succumbed to a brutal attack. The autopsy would later reveal that Alison had been stabbed numerous times in her abdomen and chest. Her killer had slit her throat so savagely that all that prevented complete decapitation was her spinal column and a thin piece of skin at the back of her neck. Alison's face had been savagely attacked, too. The pathologist would determine that the wounds had been caused by bite marks,
Her nose and cheek were damaged, and her lip had almost been completely torn away from her face. The blades of two knives remained embedded in her body, with the handles lying nearby alongside a third knife. This had clearly been very personal, and backed by an enormous amount of rage and hatred. Both the forensics teams at the scene and the pathologist would later note that despite the huge amount of blood presence, Allison's lower pants and her shoes were pristinely clean. This indicated two things. She likely had not stood up after the first sharp force injury was sustained, and her killer had probably been straddling her waist as he stabbed her, and his body had blocked the spatter of blood from reaching her jeans. A pair of men's tracksuit pants were found in Allison's shower, drenched in blood. Palm prints and fingerprints were also found in blood all around the flat. They belonged to the killer. It didn't take long for a suspect to be revealed to investigating officers. Rolene April had to share the information she knew about her son. She tried phoning him, but he was not taking her calls, and police were also advised that Philip was driving Allison's car. It would later emerge that in the hours after Philip April had returned to his friend's house, they'd gone on a road trip with Allison's car. They'd visited various other friends' houses and stopped at taverns along the way. At one stage, the sister of Philip's friend had driven off in Allison's car and left the men at a house where they'd gotten into a fight. Eventually, they'd both ended up back in Allison's car. Throughout Saturday evening and into Sunday morning, Philip ignored phone calls from his mother. Eventually on Sunday, the friend's own mother began calling as well, and while he initially also ignored these calls, he finally did answer, and his mother told him that they needed to bring the car back because Allison had been in an accident and the police wanted the car. The man had been confused as to how Allison had been in an accident if they had her car, but when he conveyed the message to Philip, Philip started to cry. He didn't want to go back, though, and insisted that he wanted to visit some other friends. At one point during Sunday morning, the friend alleges that Rolene had figured out where Philip was and arrived, but Philip had sped away as soon as he saw her. It was very clear that right from the start, the main suspect was Philip April, and police had immediately put out a be on the lookout for Allison's vehicle registration. Although it's not specifically noted anywhere, I'm pretty certain that the call from the friend's mom was orchestrated by police. No one knew what state of mind Philip was in, and if they told him outright that Allison had been found brutally murdered and Philip was the main suspect, who knew what the young man might do to himself and possibly even to his friends. By telling him that they thought it was an accident, this may have been a way to ease him into the idea of coming back. The eventual arrest, though, would come, as they so often do, purely from luck. The men claim that as they were headed back to Clanwilliam, they drove out of Citrusdal and a traffic officer had pulled them over. After ascertaining their identities, the officer told them to wait where they were, and a few minutes later, a police van arrived, and they arrested Philip April. His friend was utterly confused and wouldn't really get a full explanation until many months later. By the early hours of Sunday morning, news of Allison's murder was filtering through to her family. Philip April's mother had phoned Allison's mother to deliver the heartrending news. The woman says that all she managed to get out was, "Something bad has happened to Allison." There were two distinct reactions to the news. "It cannot be true. Someone has made a mistake." And "Philip definitely did it." As was the case with his mother, all the friends and teachers at Cedarburg Primary who had known Alison and Philip as a couple immediately knew that he had finally carried out his threat. It was still a shock to many who hadn't been privy to this information, and even those who had known about the stalking and abuse still had a part of them that couldn't quite believe that Philip had actually gone through with it. When Philip confessed in custody, though, everyone would have to start to come to terms with the truth. On the day after her death, Alison's older cousin went to the mortuary to identify her body. Although Alison was mostly covered up, it was impossible to hide the terrible damage to her face, and that's when it started to dawn on her family that this had not just been a fight in which Philip had lost his cool and punched Alison too hard, for instance. Alison had been slaughtered. In addition to the horror of knowing what had been done to her, the older members of Alison's family then also began to learn about all the abuse and stalking she'd gone through in the past 2 years, and how she'd hidden so much of it from them. The world was suddenly a completely different place, and nothing would ever be the same. Philip April was charged with murder as well as the theft of a motor vehicle. He agreed to plead guilty to murder, but refused to plead guilty to stealing Alison's car, as he claimed that she'd always allowed him to use the vehicle. In the first formal hearing, the prosecution told the judge that they were not willing to accept April's plea because he was claiming that he had not premeditated Alison's murder, and they believed he had, and they were sure that they could prove it. In addition, they could definitely prove that he was guilty of stealing Alison's car. And so, the trial would proceed. As the prosecutor outlined the reasons why they wouldn't be accepting his plea, Philip April shook his head, laughed, and rolled his eyes. At one of the first appearances, an interesting interaction took place between Philip's mother and two journalists in the courtroom. They were taking photographs of Philip, which is their job, and Philip's mother, Rolene, started screaming at them to stop. She insisted that they were publishing her son's face all over the front pages of newspapers and online and making him look bad. She screamed at the shocked journalists that there were reasons why her son had done what he'd done, and no one was taking those reasons into account. The woman's fury was so intense that they requested to sit in a separate section, away from her, for the rest of the hearing. Although the trial was supposed to restart in the new year, lockdown happened, and the next time April appeared in court was in May 2020. The prosecution was by then bogged down by the backlog lockdown had caused, and Philip April had not managed to secure an attorney yet either, so the trial was postponed to August. Because of the nature of the crime, the case was to be heard in the High Court in Cape Town. As a result, every time there was a delay, it was causing Alison's friends and family members to have to spend huge amounts of time and money in travelling from Swellendam to Cape Town. But they took turns and toughed it out. They felt they had to be there for Alison. Only one additional pretrial hearing would be held throughout the entirety of the rest of 2020, and not much progress was made there, except to say that April had applied to legal aid for assistance. In September that year, Alison's family marked her first birthday since her death, and the following month, the one-year anniversary of her murder. They could only hope that justice would be served before too long. Although long-time True Crime South Africa listeners will likely know why it was so important to the prosecution that premeditation be proven, I think I'll take a minute to explain it for clarity's sake. In South Africa, we have a murder charge, But that charge on its own does not imply either the existence or lack of premeditation. Because the existence of premeditation is only often revealed in the course of an investigation, it's safer to have a catch-all charge, which covers the illegal and intentional taking of another human life without including the complexity of whether that murder was planned up front. Instead, once the investigation has revealed evidence of premeditation, or a lack thereof, the prosecution can then tackle this in trial. And the reason it's important that someone like Alison's killer be proven to have premeditated the murder is because it makes a huge difference to sentencing. Judges can hand down a life sentence for premeditated murder. The sentence for a murder that was not premeditated is often far less, a determinate sentence of 20 years, for instance, or even less, which results in an offender being eligible for parole at 10 years, or even sooner if the sentence is lighter. Especially in cases where the murder is as a result of domestic violence, it's vital to get the heaviest sentence possible to ensure that the longest period is available for rehabilitation. Research and data shows that individuals who engage in coercive control, stalking, and domestic violence behaviors are very difficult to rehabilitate, and the pattern of their past relationships almost always shows this behavior with other partners, which provides a pretty solid indication that it will continue in the future if there is no intervention. And so, this is why, despite how much easier it would have been to simply accept the plea and move on, Alison and all of Philip's future possible partners deserved better. Again, in 2021, just one hearing would be held for this case in the entire year, with the promise that in 2022, 3 years after Alison's murder, the trial would begin in earnest. And it did. On the 3rd of August 2022, Philip April's version of events was read out in court. The young man told the court how he and Alison had met, how they'd been in a relationship, and how he had failed his exam for the second time and he was feeling down about himself. It soon became clear that Philip's version did not include anything abusive or controlling that he'd done toward Alison. And almost unbelievably, he claimed that they were still in a relationship on the day he killed her. These points would form part of what the state later sought to prove untrue. On the day of the murder, Philip claimed that Alison had insisted he come home with her, and then when they arrived at her flat, she'd argued with him because he was drunk, and then told him that he needed to leave so she could get ready for the commitment she had that night. He said that he'd become angry because she dragged him away from his friends only to tell him to leave. Now, I'll just pause here and say that I think this is absolute nonsense. From all of her prior behaviour and reactions to Philip on record in the preceding days, it was very clear that Alison wanted to spend as little time as possible around him. I firmly believe, as did many others, that Philip talked his way into Alison's car and home that night. And she thought that since she had a prior engagement set up, it would be easier to get rid of him. Perhaps she'd hoped if she just gave him some time to talk about his failed exam, he would leave her alone. Philip April, though, claims that this was not the case, and he had become enraged with Alison and grabbed her around the throat while they were standing in the lounge. Please do note that the following descriptions are extremely graphic. April says that he pulled Alison by her throat into the bedroom and he was squeezing so tight that by the time he threw her onto the ground there, she was semi-conscious. She'd whispered to him, "Please leave me alone." But instead, he'd gone into the kitchen and taken a knife out of the drawer. Then he had straddled her and plunged the knife into her chest several times. He had stabbed her with such force that the blade had broken off. But instead of stopping, he'd gone back to the kitchen and fetched another two knives. He stabbed Alison several more times, while she'd used the last of her strength to attempt to fight him off. And then, when she stopped struggling, he'd gotten off her, moved to the top of her body, pulled her head back, and began to slice away at her throat. The knives he was using were not particularly sharp, he said, so it had taken a long time. He also admitted to biting Alison's face and causing the injury which had almost severed her lower lip from her face by doing so. When he was sure she was dead, he'd gotten up and taken off his tracksuit pants, leaving them in her shower. He'd then driven to his mother's house, where he'd showered and changed, and then he'd gone back to his friend's house. April insisted that he had not planned to kill Alison, and it had all happened on the spur of the moment because they were arguing and she was complaining that he was drunk again and he simply couldn't take it anymore. Over the next few days, the state called several witnesses to the stand who testified to the abuse, stalking and control that Alison had endured from Philip, as well as the fact that he threatened to kill her if she ever left him. Witnesses also testified that Alison had told them just days before her murder that she'd broken up with Philip for good. The WhatsApp messages I read earlier were also read into evidence. When the pathologist gave her testimony, it also became clear that there were several moments throughout the murder where Philip could have stopped and called an ambulance and Alison may have survived. The pathologist found that from the various injuries and the defensive wounds she saw, it was very likely that Alison had been conscious for much of the attack and she'd bled to death. In fact, the woman said, her injuries were so extensive that there was almost no blood left in Alison's body. Jeshvida Steenkamp, who'd been there that night when Alison's body was discovered, also testified that just the night before, she and Alison had sat drinking wine in her flat, and Alison had said that she and Philip were broken up, but that he didn't want to leave her alone and he was aggressive. She also mentioned that he'd extended his degradation to her family behind their back, saying that he didn't want her to be too close to them because they were uneducated people. When the state rested, Philip April decided not to take the stand in his own defence, and the defence rested as well. The judge set down the judgment date for October 2022. On the 27th of October, 3 years to the day that Philip April was arrested for Alison's murder, he was found guilty of her murder and the theft of her vehicle. Additionally, the judge said that she felt premeditation had been proven. She pointed out that the legal definition of premeditation did not require that the offender have planned the crime for weeks or even days before the event. Even minutes of pre-planning and thoughtful calculation of actions was enough to prove premeditation. And in her opinion, this is exactly what Philip April had done. He had not lost his mind and beaten Alison to death in a so-called crime of passion. The murder had been carried out in stages, during which he'd had plenty of time to stop, but he instead used that time to retrieve more weapons and inflict even more damage to Alison's body. In addition, witness testimony, which the judge accepted, proved that he had threatened to kill Alison before, which meant that this was something that had been on his mind for some time. As for the theft of the vehicle, the judge found that whether or not Alison had allowed him to use the vehicle while they were in a relationship, they were not, by virtue of the evidence, in a relationship at that time, and therefore there was no reason for Philip to assume it would be okay for him to take a car which did not belong to him and to which he had no legal tie. From my own perspective, Philip April honestly thinking that there was no problem with him taking Alison's car and his claims that she'd let him use it before being his reasoning show me one additional bright red flag about this man, as if we need any more. He clearly does not understand consent. His statement makes the assumption that because someone has allowed you to use their vehicle once, that consent somehow extends forever. And I hate to break it to you, but that's not how consent works. In addition, I can't imagine a world where anyone would think that your ex-girlfriend, who you've just viciously murdered, would be okay with you taking her vehicle, as though absolutely nothing has changed between you. But apparently Philip April lives in that world. Thankfully the judge and the rest of us do not. In December, when sentencing procedures were underway, the prosecutor summarized Philip April as a handsome and intelligent young man who viewed Alison Plykes as his property and nothing more than a possession which he had the right to control and do with as he pleased. She told the judge that his confession was tactical and not born in remorse, as he knew he wasn't going to get away with the murder, but figured that if he admitted his guilt but claimed he'd snapped and acted without premeditation, he could get a lighter sentence and maybe even be out of prison before he turned 40. April's defense attorney said that Philip had suffered from depression for a long time, and now that his mental health had culminated in this terrible event, he understood that he needed psychological assistance and was planning on making full use of the mental health services available to him. After a break for the festive season, finally in January 2023, the long-awaited sentence was handed down. The judge found that there was very little to be considered in mitigation of sentence, and instead aggravation weighed heavily on the other side. And so she sentenced Philip April to life in prison, as well as 5 years for the car theft. Philip April will be eligible for parole in 2044, when he is 51 years old. In the beginning of this episode, I mentioned that there was something specific that one of Alison's family members said which stuck with me, and I wanted to highlight. It's not uncommon for us to see victims of domestic violence having come from violent homes themselves. That circle occurs for its own reasons. The behavior is normalized and feels like the way things should be to many victims without them even having that conscious thought. But Alison didn't come from a violent home. And her older cousin, Liesl, who said she felt like Alison's second mother and who identified her savaged body in the mortuary, told the Heiskenoordvare Levensdrama's producers that she feels like, in a way, they may have let Alison down by not preparing her for the world. She says that although it's supposed to be the ideal that one grows up the way Alison did, with nothing to worry about and thinking the world is a wonderful place and everyone is kind, that did not prepare her for what she found when she met Philip April. She encourages families to speak with all of their children about the different types of people they may encounter, especially in their dating relationships, but also in friendships, and what sort of red flags they should look out for. While a family might feel it's their responsibility to shield a child from the darkness of the world, there comes a time when it's also vital to prepare them for the eventuality that darkness will cross their paths. She feels that they could have better equipped Alison for what she encountered with Philip April. And that may have made some difference. And I think that is a fair and very insightful assessment. It obviously does not take away any of the guilt from April for what he's done. And I think we can have a completely separate discussion about how his parents, specifically his mother, from the examples we saw, may or may not have enabled him in his behaviour. But Liesl hopes it's a lesson that Alison's story can present, and perhaps one that might help save another future victim. Over and again, we see individuals blaming abuse victims for not leaving or for going back. But everything is clear in hindsight. When your head is beneath the surface of the water, you can't always see the life buoy bobbing just a meter beside you. You might think that your furious paddling is the best course of action. But it's easy for the people in the boat to see the life buoy, because their perspective is different. They aren't struggling for their lives. So they just can't see why you would think that flailing around is better than reaching for the device that could save you. And they think you must be mad, because can't you see it? It's right there. Just reach for it. But all you can see is water. And all you can feel is the burning of your lungs as you gasp for breath and the water wins. Alison Plikes, rest gently.
If you'd like to hear more victim-focused true crime content, please subscribe to True Crime South Africa on Spotify or the platform you're using to listen right now. If you're looking for something still related to real-life stories, but often with a more positive slant, you can check out my new podcast series, I Live Through This. You can follow both podcasts on social media. We're on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'll be back next week with another episode. Until then, thank you for your support, and I'll chat to you soon.